Welcome, everybody, back to another episode of Chronicles Magazine podcast. I'm happy to be joined today by a good friend of mine from our libertarian years, Buck Johnson. I actually was just on your show a couple weeks ago, but I wanted to do a similar thing over here on this channel. But we're going to be talking a lot about religion, maybe a little bit of our experience in libertarian circles and sort of what's going on in our minds individually, what's kind of driven us away from that world, but also what's going on sort of maybe at a more corporate level, like, you know, just at a bird's eye level. There's a lot of people that are making this transformation. We're not alone. We're all sort of, there's a spirit of return with a V in the air, and kind of we all feel it. I wanted to just get into that a little bit, but this is sort of a pan-Christendom conversation. You know, there's a lot of people that listen to Chronicles that are deeply Roman Catholic. Others have more of a classical Protestantism. There's Anglicans and Reformed and Lutherans, and you yourself are involved in Eastern Orthodoxy. So we can just talk about things at a general level, and then maybe more, we'll pick apart your brain a little bit more specifically. But I guess first things first, maybe tell us a little bit about your background and what you do, and why in your perception, I'm interested in talking with you.
Well, I'm Buck Johnson. I run the Counterflow podcast. I'm an Orthodox Christian. I live in Lockhart, Texas, which is the barbecue capital of Texas. I'm a lieutenant in the fire department. I don't say which one because I don't want to get those worlds crossed. That kind of gets me in trouble with some of the themes I discuss on my show. But it is a large city in Texas where I've done that for over 25 years. And which it's really, that's probably given me a unique perspective on something. That's the only job I've ever had career wise. And so that's been great, really. And you and I both went through some libertarian times. I will say, I think for you, one of the things I was always drawn to this, your content, was because outside of a small window of time in my life, I was always more to the right in the libertarian sphere. In fact, prior to becoming libertarian, I was involved like in a secessionist movement in the United States. And so, and I knew of Chronicles, geez, for a long time. I'm honored to be on this podcast. Chronicles has been great for me. I love Paul Gottfried and his content, Pat Buchanan and his writing. So this is pretty cool. And both of us have ditched the old libertarian label.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you had Paul on your show? I'm sure you have.
I have a few times back when it was Death to Tyrants prior to being the Counterflow.
Let's start with that. Why that transition? I mean, maybe it's reflective of your overall, you know, journey. We both hate that word. Yeah.
Yes. A little bit. I had joined in a business venture, I guess you could say, a podcast network when it was called Death to Tyrants, and the guy running it was like, he wanted me to start a different show. And I was like, dude, I can't. This is already, even once a week when you work in the fire department, you're gone for 24 hours every third day. So just putting out one episode per week was, you know, you have to study the books on the, by the guest and do a lot of background work. So that was tying up time. And I said, you know what? I've been thinking about changing the name anyway, because I had people in the ANCAP world, the anarcho-capitalist world, turn me down because of the name Death to Tyrants. And I knew that was one of the reasons, turned me down for coming on. So I've been thinking about changing it. And that seemed like a good time. It was as we were going into, oddly enough, 2020. And so at the first of the year, I believe it was in 2020, my first episode might've been New Year's Day or something like that. Within a short time after New Year's, I changed it to Counterflow. And when I found that name at the time, I was still atheist, crazy enough. But everything from my musical taste to my politics and philosophy, everything I was into was counter, if you will, to the mainstream, sure, including my job. And someone brought that up like, well, you're running in as everyone runs out of this burning building. So even that is flowing counter. I was like, see, it's perfect.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how that happened. And then I didn't get into Christianity for another year or so after that.
Yeah. I mean, how does one, I grew up in broad, like evangelical circles, you know, I'm a Californian, lifelong Californian. So it's like the world of mega churches and all that kind of, you know, like celebrity Christianity. You know, so in my own way, you know, I've made these transformations as well. But what causes an atheist in our time to step away from that?
The spiritual reality, in my opinion, that showed its good and its ugly over 2020 and 2021. Mm-hmm. That's when I started, because being libertarian, everything's everything's using reason and ration and rationality, and it's like certain things were displaying themselves over 2020, and it just seemed I couldn't avoid seeing it in a spiritual manner at that point. I had a guest on my show. We were talking about some of the events of 2020, and afterwards we were done recording. We were just chatting, and he said, "Dude, if you're viewing this entire what's going on in 2020 as a materialist, you've lost the plot completely. This is all a spiritual warfare battle here." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Wow, that's an interesting take." It does. He goes, "Do you think people care about charts and graphs and figures? You can literally give them state by state and it doesn't matter. This is a spiritual matter to people. No one's using logic and reason and all these things that you've tried to grapple with being a libertarian." And it's like, why aren't they listening to me? You know, I've given them the science, the real science, and all this fake masquerading science, which was in a way, in a negative way, spiritual, right? And it was kind of winning the day.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking, this goes beyond politicians and experts making poor decisions and being goofballs. Like, there's a spirit of evil behind this. And it was also animating a lot of just normal people around me that would just be taken over by this evil aura and spirit. It's like, stay at home, damn you. Take the damn shot. Like, I just thought, what in the world is happening to people right now? This is not normal. And so that started making me ask more spiritual questions.
Do you think that transformation because there's a lot of us, you see it, I see it, that people are just beginning to find the spiritual foundation of our wars. You know, like there's the meme of the astronaut, you know, and it's like a cult war is all the way down. It's like it always has been, you know, and yes. Like we forget that underneath all the materialism and all of our like human hubris about America's accomplishment in the world, there's this underlying tension, this good versus evil. And a lot of people are realizing that. Do you think that's related at all to your and my transformation away from libertarian politics?
It certainly is for mine. I suspect, having had this discussion with you a couple of weeks ago, it seems like yours as well. Because libertarianism relies so heavily on the material. And I don't even necessarily mean materialism as in like buying things good for the economy, economic standpoint of libertarianism, which I still, to some extent, like we discussed, Austrian economics, I find extremely valuable. But I mean the material, like the material world. It has to do with, are you going to aggress against someone? And it's such a thin legal definition of that's how it should be. It's a libertarian legal perspective is so thin that you can't use that to fill up your heart, your life, the people around you. That's just a strict legal aspect of what a society should be. And so for a long time, I was looking at that as like the entire thing, like liberty is the most important thing in the whole world. And I started to feel like maybe there was something inside that wasn't being filled as it should, that because that's not deep enough and real enough to actually fill the void.
Yeah. What do you think about the state of libertarianism, like as a movement? I mean, do you think it was sort of predictable where it all went?
And now looking back, I do. Yeah. When I was in the midst of it, I could see the tension even within libertarianism that I thought was never ending, right? We come from the Rothbard, Rockwell wing of libertarianism, and that tension, even when those guys are putting out their Rothbard Rockwell report, they felt the tension, right? There's, it's like this hippie faction and leftist social aspects trying to use the thin legal definition of libertarianism to essentially do whatever they want. And some of the good people within that movement, Harry Brown included, I remember reading a Harry Brown book when I was young, and he was harping on, you can't have liberty without responsibility. It's two sides. It's the same coin, right? Mm-hmm. Two sides of the same coin. And a lot of people, especially like the Reason wing of libertarian or the Cato wing of libertarianism, throughout the 2000s, when it was popular to be anti-war when Bush was in office, that they were also involved in such leftist social politics that that tension was always eating at me, and I didn't like that. And I felt like there was this urge amongst mainstream Libertarian Inc., we'll call it. I mean, in their defense, Conservatism Inc. does the same thing. I think Paul Gottfried's covered that quite a bit. But this appeal to the popular culture or the left-wing view of things, and it's like this, you can do all of that you want, the whole like, you must denounce racism or else you're a racist. And it's like, you can kiss ass to those types all you want. The second they find out you're against Obamacare, they'll put you up against the wall too. So it seemed like a futile movement as far as the it's hard to escape the leftist social aspect of libertarian circles.
It's funny because in the 90s, no, it probably wasn't even in the 90s. Maybe it was in like the 60s or 70s when Russell Kirk was calling libertarians a bunch of chirping sectaries. You know, and Rothbard was engaged in that, like that conflict between the libertarians and the conservatives. You just begin to see that there's something that's underlying the whole spirit of the conflict. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that Lou Rockwell, who's a traditionalist Catholic, right? So
yes,
that's core to his identity too. If you read the LouRockwell.com every day, you'll notice, you know, all the time they're posting traditionalist Catholic content. So, I mean, that aspect of political, you know, commentary has been there since the beginning. And the Reason Cato type, you know, the regime libertarians, basically,
yes,
they just could not care less about the health, the spiritual health of the Western people. And so, you know, you begin to see that there's this dynamic there that they don't really belong together. And the whole idea that we can create a movement based on commonality of propositional, you know, assent,
yes,
is the very thing that tore Marxism apart. You know, yep, in the first thing, that you cannot build a society on propositional agreement.
Right. Yeah, because it takes true Christianity or spirituality, if you want to use a looser term, and tosses it to the side. And you mentioned when you're on my show, this was the perfect example. It's this free state project, right? So everyone moved to New Hampshire because you are a libertarian. That's it. And I was speaking to Jeff Deist, from former president of the Mises Institute, once offline. And this was during the 2020 fiasco. And he said, you have to really stop and think at this point, would you rather live around libertarian atheists in a small society or Christian conservatives right now? And it was like, wow. Yeah. Christian conservatives. I mean, there's no question. Mm-hmm. And so that also sent me down. I just spoke with him offline again about that, and he didn't even remember having that conversation with me, but I was like, man, that kind of started me at least to open my mind to Christianity.
Yeah. But moving forward, the solution is not to join Conservative Incorporated either.
Correct.
No. You know, like a lot of our frustrations with the political apparatus are even worse in the world of conservatism too. So it's not like you've gone this journey from Mises Institute to National Review, right?
No, right. Yeah, but, like Paul Gottfried has written and spoke endlessly about what, I think because conservatism's bigger, Conservatism Inc. is obviously much bigger than Libertarianism Inc. So you've got some of the similar problems just manifesting themselves differently, but in larger factions, like there's no question. And the Trump era, the Trump phenomenon was so necessary because it really, people, the masks were off and I started to see like, wait a second, some of the political landscape's a little bit different than I thought. And the friend-enemy distinction became more clear and obvious. And I think, honestly, I think Trump is just kind of the goofy guy that got thrown in the middle of this. I don't think a lot of this was with intent on his end, but the reaction to him was just eye-opening, I thought.
Yeah. It was really disruptive too. I mean, a lot of people were kind of shaken from their political complacency with Donald Trump, you know, and you had to choose a side in a line in the sand. And we began to realize that the line wasn't like non-aggression and aggression, right?
Correct.
It's much deeper than that. People like Tom Woods, they've been long involved in traditional, you know, religion, and there's just that certain aspect of things that I think is much more rewarding, but it's also more foundational to a healthy society. So one of the things I wanted to talk about today too was like the future of the right wing. I mean, there's a lot of rightists, and we've talked with Paul Gottfried about this too, and he thinks the whole, like, you know, return to paganism movement is just kind of goofy because it's not connected to who we are. So maybe talk a little bit about like the health of the right wing and whether you see like what kind of weaknesses and strengths are there and whether Christianity is going to play a role in bolstering the true right in the West.
I hope it does. My biggest concern, and I think this has reared its head very recently and very abruptly, and it's apparent, is the, and I don't want to get you in trouble, can we say the Z word?
Yes.
Okay, is the Zionist faction within the quote unquote right. And I'm almost autistic over this because I want to get down and go, well, it's not really on the right in my opinion, but that's how it's going to be categorized. But I think if we can be very defensive against that faction and expose that for what it is, I think that's healthy on the right. And I think I'm seeing that happen more than I suspected I would. Even voices like Candace Owens, who I didn't ever, to be quite honest, pay any attention to before the last month. And she's been quite impressive on this. I think there's good voices like Tucker Carlson, who's phenomenal on many subjects. And we don't have to go down the line. I might be able to find, well, I disagree with them. But broadly speaking, for the health of the right wing, I think he's incredible, incredibly helpful. And some of the old, almost like boomer con voices that are such pro-Zionist. I mean, you talked about mega churches. I grew up from my teenage years going to Pastor John Hagee's church in San Antonio. And I don't know that there's a bigger Zionist mouthpiece than he. And he was, you know, he was promoting John McCain back in 2008, if that was. And so I think that wing of, if you want to call it Conservatism Inc., needs to be flushed away. And if that can happen, I think the future of the right is healthy. I certainly think the current regime is extremely weak, and there's going to have to be, you can't just overturn a regime and completely have new grassroots growing up and all the old's gone. You have to have someone within the regime say, wait a second, something's going on and I don't like it here. I think voices like Elon Musk, what they call the PayPal Mafia, Peter Thiel, and people like that, while I might not align with them very much at all, the fact that they are somewhat working within the regime to what appears to be crack through and overthrow some of it, I think is a positive thing.
Yeah. So, in regards to like the religious aspect of the right, I wanted to get your take, like what draws someone to something like Eastern Orthodoxy in the first place? Is it just that, is it a reaction to materialism? Do you think that's a large part of it?
That's part of it for me personally. And I do think this is not just me after having a lot of conversations with young Orthodox, specifically male converts, is that the nature within me to want the purest form of whatever I'm into. So Orthodoxy was that for me. I did the same thing with music. Like when I was a libertarian, I didn't want, let's say, Gary Johnson or Reason Libertarianism. I wanted Rothbard, Hoppe, and these guys that took it down to its purest, most hardcore, if you will, form. And so I wanted to open my mind to Christianity once again. And so I I started looking into Orthodoxy because I had a few friends that were. They kept saying Orthodox, and I said, well, you guys have a very interesting and unique take on everything that's going on. What is Orthodoxy? And so I started educating myself on that. And it's like, well, it's the first church. And then, and they gave me that kind of a quick lowdown, dirty history on the splits within the church over the decades or centuries, if you will. And it was like, oh, well, I like that first one. What's, I want to learn more about that. Like, why would I want to go post reform? Like, let's go back to the book of Acts and whatnot. And so I got into it because of that. And then once I went to a liturgy, a few liturgies, met my priest, you know, I felt awkward. For one, I stand out. I'm a bigger guy and I'm covered with tattoos. And I thought, oh man, I'm going to this holy place and they're going to think I look weird. I don't want to talk about politics because my politics are fringe. And none of that was important. And even shooting the crap with him afterwards, my priest said, well, you know, no one dislikes the communists more than the Orthodox. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess we can talk about politics. I feel safe with that intro. And he discussed how the communists and Bolsheviks, how they basically martyred more Orthodox Christians than you could ever imagine. And that's what made so many of the saints. And so learning this was just, I kept thinking, why didn't anyone tell me this before? Why didn't Pastor Hagee talk about these things? Why was it all Israel? Mm-hmm. And then I learned what the true Israel has nothing to do with the state of Israel. It's the body of Christ. And my mind is still to this day. It's not like I learned Orthodoxy and I'm done. To this day, it's like an endless gulf of knowledge and spiritual development to dig into. A priest told me when I was Protestant, I felt like I was swimming in the shallow end of the pool. And when I became Orthodox, it felt like they had a helicopter, Pinochet style, and dropped me into an ocean and said, swim. And it's like, it just doesn't stop.
Yeah.
I find that appealing.
You mentioned the communist war on the Christian faith. And mm-hmm. you think a lot of this too, maybe comment on the regime's war on religion. I mean, they dress everything up in Christian language, right? So, so like their own like LGBT endeavors and shoving it down our throat is always couched in Christianity. But there's an element of not an element. It's like it seems to me there's a main part of what they are doing that is war on the Christian religion, war on Christian history. So maybe talk a little bit about that. Like, what is it about Christianity that regimes just cannot deal with? Why do they have to? Why does it come out of them that they despise the Christian faith?
Because it's truth, and leftism is the opposite of the inverse. Everything satanic is the inverse of Christianity. So God, Christ is truth. You know, it says that in the Bible specifically. And so egalitarianism, I'm going to jump around here a lot, but I think the spiritual warfare manifests itself through political means. So that's what I'm getting at here. And egalitarianism is fake and a lie. It cannot, it's literally impossible. And the fact that it's based and rooted in complete lies shows to me that it's the inversion of Christ and truth. And Christianity is hierarchical. So if you look at the right being rooted and believing in hierarchy as its foundation, which I do, and the left being egalitarianism and its foundation, anything leftist has to try to dismantle truth. And so they're couching their war on us with our terms. And I think the left itself, especially nowadays, because this is as I know them, but they're puritanical in nature. Mm-hmm. And the pinch of incense that the pagans used to want Christians to give, it's the left does it right now. As you said, their secular religion is this LGBT alphabet soup thing. And it's like, just put the flag up. Just put the thing on your profile picture. Just a pinch of incense. That's all they want, because then they know they have you. And the hook, the demonic hook that's sunk deep inside them, they just want to get it inside you just a little bit. And so anyone that fights the pinch of incense, it's historical. This stuff's not new, right? It rhymes. that's what, then your enemy, public enemy number one, if you've got a big enough platform or profile, that's when they really try to hammer you down. But we saw that even throughout 2020. I had so many strikes on YouTube for having people say things that are factually correct, but it went against the lies that the regime was founding their entire narrative on. So you got to be off. You can't be on here. Strike, kicked off, that kind of thing. It's amazing to watch it happen in real time, but it's even wilder to look back and go, my goodness, I didn't say anything incorrect.
Yeah, exactly.
But the regime, the leftist regime, is built on lies. And so they hate Christianity because it's rooted in truth, in Christ.
Right, exactly. One of the things that you become aware of when you study like the historic faith, whether that's Catholicism, Lutheranism, Anglicanism, Orthodox, is you begin to realize the importance of icons and symbols and signs. And you see that just because society has been secularized doesn't actually mean that it's been secularized in the way that they want you to think it has. The symbols are there. The signs are there. You still have, blasphemy laws. You still have creeds and confessions and formulas and rites, right? So like, maybe talk about that. I mean, maybe like, let's talk about secularity. Like maybe that's all a lie and that these things are religious in nature.
100%.
Do you have any experience in thinking about that whole side of things?
I do. I just recorded an episode based on puritanical secular religion because the priest that I was with interviewing, and I've been thinking the same thing. I keep telling people I was an atheist, but at the same time, there's no such thing as an atheist. Mm-hmm. You can say, I don't believe in the Christian God, but you are going to feel, worship is just attention. You are going to fill the void or attempt to fill the void within with something. You are going to give a majority of your attention to something. That's your God. And if you're a Christian, it should be God. And oftentimes we all fall and fail at this. Maybe it's we're looking at our phones too much, or we're doing this or that, or concentrating on Fox versus CNN. But whatever the case is, you are going to feel something. And there is no such thing as actual atheism in the respects that we all have our gods. It's just you might not be aware, you might not call yours that, but certainly if you're in the alphabet soup movement, that's they're more devout than many Christians are to their cause, much more.
Right.
And I think we're seeing it with the Zionism thing too. I mean, look at what Ben Shapiro did. Everything's cool. We're on the right. Yeah, we're all in the same category here until you speak against the taboo thing that you can't say. And as soon as you denounce Zionism or, geez, if you say Christ is king, then all of a sudden we have a problem. And so I think it's interesting, and it's the emperor has no clothes moment. I think we've been in that for a few years now. You're starting to see people's true colors and what they actually represent. And if you don't understand that as spiritual, I would suggest maybe start looking at that as a spiritual war, because that's what it is. And just because Ben Shapiro is against high tax rates, and so are you, and he's against affirmative action, unless it's for Zionists, and so are you, I would look at those things as very, very surface level and try to get deeper below the surface. Because again, they might call it secular, but it's secular religion. And the second you go against the alphabet soup thing and you don't put the flag up, then you're marked for martyrdom, essentially.
Have you read Paul Gottfried's Multiculturalism and the Politics of Guilt?
That was my first book of his that I read.
Yeah, yes. Mine too. I mean, that's one of the prevailing themes of his entire understanding of the framing of American society in the 20th century was the secularization of puritanical roots, right?
Yep.
So like in the progressive era, you see the state and its, secularizing tendencies as basically taking over Christianity first, but then applying these secular puritanical themes on American society. And then it becomes this you know, you all the things that they claimed about that were bad about, like, the, you know, the pre-enlightened world, the pre-enlightened Western Christendom, has suddenly become, you know, their tool. I mean, they're the ones that are now extremely oppressive. And if you dissent from the cathedral, I mean, this comes from, you know, people like Moldbug, right? I forgot his Gervin. But, like, you know, there is a cathedral there. There is a religious, you know, you do have a priest caste and you do have all these aspects because that's what it means to be human. We're inherently religious creatures.
Correct.
And so it just strikes me as obvious, becoming increasingly obvious, that there is no true right wing without the religious components to it, because to be on the right is to believe in history and to believe in, you know, a realist perspective of anthropology. And if you deny religion, you can't actually, you know, have those things.
And hierarchy, we get hierarchy from Christ. The church, Christianity, is rooted in hierarchical language. The entire worldview, etymology, whatever you want to call it, is hierarchical, which is on the right. And then to your point about their symbols and their icons, think about just the pressure during the Summer of Love with George Floyd. You better put that black square on your social media thing. You better put that black square. Oh, he didn't put a black square. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, again, the pinch of incense. Pride Month's coming up here in June. You better, if you got a business, you better put a rainbow. And think of how many people were putting those signs in their yard, BLM or We Believe in Science, just to avoid their house getting ransacked during the summer of 2020. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what that was. And, you know, I can get into deeper theological associations too. Fauci was the high priest. The jab was communion. Mm-hmm. The mask was the rosary. There's so many symbolism elements to what happened.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the mask thing itself, I mean, you knew who is saved and who is unsaved. I mean, you can just tell there's these outward signs, these outward seals of, you know, your involvement in the church. I mean, it can all be seen in religious. I think that's unavoidable when you deal with human society.
Yep. And there may still be people now wearing the masks that actually think, oh, I'm being safe. But I wholly believe a majority of people that had them on that weren't just doing it because they were told to in a store, the ones that voluntarily did it were doing it to signal. This is a signal. This is symbolizing something, that I'm on this side of good.
Right, exactly.
They weren't actually thinking, well, I won't get sick if I do this. There's enough proof that we knew that was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So there is religious symbolism through all of that.
Yeah. How much do you think this desire to return to something more ancient is sort of a reaction to the sort of the mindless presentism that affects us? Like, there's no history. I mean, history started, you know, in Nuremberg or in the civil rights movement. Like, that's where history started. Everything before that was evil. But do you think a lot of us are like, this actually is not fulfilling at all for our humanity? Talk about the religious aspect of that, maybe.
You're giving it you're giving it too much credit. I think a lot of people think history started when Barack Obama got elected or something.
Yeah.
But it's empty. For one, we're inundated with media and with things all around, the black mirrors on our phones. But so that's part of it. It's just, we're not meant to intake this much information so quickly, immediately, and to fire out our opinion to thousands of people. We're not made to do that, quite frankly. And think of, like, I think of Christian Orthodox saints and even modern day ones like Father Seraphim Rose and these guys that were living in our times, like in the Bay Area in the 60s, he witnessed the hippie culture, the Eastern mysticism culture. And even he started feeling like there's too much going on that's not real. This is empty. It's hollow. It's shallow. And I think humans have a natural want to feel something that's actually real. I mean, I think plenty of people will say, you know, you're looking at your phone and it's like, I got to go outside. Even the stupid saying, go touch grass, like that is somehow rooted in the real fact and truth that we are longing to actually be tied to something that's real and physical and not just this empty, like, oh, hey, yeah, Trump did this, Biden said this. It's like, return to your roots is something that I think I mean, I think Black culture has that, an element of it that's that they're feeling, right? They want to find out Black history and their Black leaders and whatnot. But that's fine. But then it feels like even some modern day conservatives, I one of the times I was disappointed in Tucker was when he's talking to Vladimir Putin, and Putin goes into this history lesson about why everything led up to Russia and Ukraine. And Tucker goes, oh, didn't need a history lesson. It's like, well, yeah, you do, because this war didn't start 2 years ago or three. Like, you're talking about a culture, two cultures that have been, because of the US and NATO largely, but have been split for at least the last 10 years since 2014, when these things went down with Victoria Nuland and all that was going on there. You at least need to know that part. Mm-hmm. And so I think even him saying, well, I didn't need a history lesson, it's like, if that's a common sentiment with people, I would push back and say that you might need one.
Yeah. You might. Yeah. It's funny. Cause like, you know, I have people I know just in my area, and they just have no interest in history at all, like where they came from, you know? But I think that that's sort of almost a dying mentality. I think a lot of people do actually want to know their roots, because I think one of the things that comes out of that, as we come away from like secularity and liberalism and all of its claims and promises, is we realize that there's more to who we are than just our present individual moment. You know, yes. Like we actually belong to something that preceded our own life, and we belong to something that will come after our own life. And I think that sort of mentality is inherently contradictory to the claims of the post-war American, you know, mentality. This idea that there is something broader here. There's not just me, my own moment, my own pleasures.
Mm-hmm. I think it's generational to an extent, and not to throw an entire generation on the bus, but the baby boomer generation seemed to be the first one to kind of disassociate themselves in lifestyle, let's say family patterns and whatnot, from the previous generations. They started having less kids. The wives, that was where the wives started going to college more so. You know, my mom didn't finish, but she almost got her degree. Her mom didn't even go, right? So as these generations moved on, the boomers were the first one to kind of disassociate with maybe what was a historically rooted tradition and family respect and whatnot. In fact, when I started, I was the first in my family to start looking down through a family tree before 23andMe and these things were out like that. I actually was going to the library and trying to figure out like past relatives and go through the war on Northern aggression history and who was on which side. And my boomer parents were like, well, that's neat. We never thought about doing that. Like, you didn't?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. There's just no curiosity in that generation. And you can just see, and it's kind of reflected in like the spirit of this market economy. And I wouldn't call it a free market economy, but you can totally, there's this like obsession with change, yeah. You know? And I know that's sort of like, you know, a lot of people think that's a ridiculous type of critique, but I think a lot of like traditionalists are beginning to realize that there's something to it. There's something uncohesive, if that's even a word, that there's something that's tearing apart society that comes from our obsession with tomorrow's innovation. And I wonder if it's even sustainable to think about all the things that, you know, Elon Musk is doing and all the innovation stuff. But there's actually a counter tendency among younger people that are not interested in that because they want to rediscover. So there's this tension between like what Elon Musk is doing, but also this spirit of return, you know, return with a V. There's like this tension there. Do you have any comment on that? Do you think the people that are pursuing virtual reality and things like that are going to be successful? Or do you think there's going to be a wholesale rejection of it?
I think there's going to be a wholesale rejection of aspects of it, because VR, virtual reality, and artificial intelligence, that's so broad. Those terms are so broad that you could mean anything from a fake sex bot girlfriend to just an app that can help you type a paper or give your podcast a cool image. So the ones that were the forces trying to make some sort of sentient beings with AI, I hope that there could be some sort of mass rejection of that sort of thing. I do think that things that, and I'm coming into this kicking and screaming, I've never used AI anything that, oh, I actually have for video shorts for my podcast. But those type of things, I could see people going, well, it does make things easier, kind of like an app on a cell phone versus a smartphone versus having a flip phone. However, to your point, though, imagine being of the Zoomer generation now and coming up. I'm trying to wrap my mind around this, coming up where they're feeding you the same things that I was fed, that you were fed, like, oh, if you go to school and you form a family and you can buy a house. And it's like, are you kidding me? No, you can't.
Right.
So I think being of the Zoomer generation, you have an easier time not falling for the BS that certainly millennials have fallen for. And to an extent, for whatever reason, Generation X still was pushing back. I don't know why we did that, because we were left to our own devices. I suppose my parents were always at work and we just did whatever. But this helicopter parent raised generation, this is all fake. And so I think it's easier for them to go, I'm not listening to this crap, and to blow off all of some of the modernity and because it's all garbage. And I think it's easier for a younger generation now that you come up in your, let's say, 22, and you look at the landscape of everything that's going on. How on earth would you believe that all this modernity has been a good thing when you look around and everything's fake? And yeah. So I think within that generation, we're going to see some wise young men and women coming up. And we've already seen that. I know you were on the Jay Burden show, but people like that, especially in the right, boy, it's refreshing when I hear their voices.
Yeah, for sure. I have four younger brothers, you know, and it's interesting because I was like I have one younger brother who's closer to my age, but we kind of preceded the internet in a way. Like, we still have like residues of memory before it all existed, you know.
They're the last generation.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, they literally do not know. They can't conceive of a world where they don't have these things. And yet at the same time, they wonder what it was like before. Mm-hmm. In a way that actually, like, boomers always say, oh, young people are addicted to their technology or whatever, but they wonder about the past in a way that those older generations actually don't wonder. They're just, mm-hmm. are stuck in front of the TV. And as things like Fox News and CNN and MSNBC are less and less part of the making of our minds,
yep.
You know, people begin to distinguish between the world before and, you know, the world of like TV propaganda, you know.
Yes.
That helps the momentum as well.
That is huge. And I love my parents, by the way, but I do see a tendency, if Fox News says it, it's true. And I think that's that boomer generation. And I'll obviously on the left, there's boomers that say the same thing about MSNBC. I get it. But there's that tendency to inherently trust what the quote unquote experts that you like are telling you. And I think the younger generation, your younger brothers and the Zoomers, that's not inherently there, because they all look at, no, they don't have cable for one, usually. And they would see a Sean Hannity and no one would take that seriously, I hope. And right. And same with Rachel Maddow. And like, these people look, they look, the further you get away from their claws and being in that grasp, the sillier it looks.
Yeah. So let's bring this back around now. You know, as like this, you know, to use a story from Paul, you know, as the scales fall from our eyes, you know, as a society, and we realize that the experts and professionals and the people that have been, you know, well-credentialed are actually not leading us in good directions, we have to seek our wisdom elsewhere. And I think that's where the religious aspect comes in as well, because these are timeless nuggets and treatises and, you know, just lakes, like you mentioned, the ocean, oceans of just wisdom that supersede hundreds of years of human hubris. And I think that we're longing for it as humans. We're longing for something that's sort of timeless. This is what Russell Kirk and T.S. Eliot referred to as the permanent things. So there's this aspect of conservatism where we can connect with the past, but at the same time, it's not 20th century conservatism. It's actually much more reactionary. And perhaps our posture has to be more reactionary. So maybe just in the last couple of minutes, we can just talk about, you know, what it means to be a reactionary today. You know, what are some of the possible pitfalls of being a reactionary? But why do we need to have that perspective more than just a lackadaisical conservative one?
That's a great point. And I agree with the sentiment of it. You have to, well, I think it's healthy to be a reactionary in that we're still surrounded by regime propaganda, if you will, on both sides.
Right.
I think the Zionist stuff you need to be careful with on the right and on the left, all of it. And so to react against that, I understand the danger in painting yourself as a revolutionary reactionary is that sometimes you're putting what your quote unquote enemy in the driver's seat, and you're just reacting to what they do rather than like making something organic of that's your own, or creating your own worldview, your space, whatever you want to call it, your family. But to just say, to sit and watch TV and react and get mad and, oh, the LGBT, you know, and to focus all your energy on that becomes negative. And so I think the pitfall to watch for is that one, to understand what you're reacting against, the evil, what's essentially what I would call a satanic presence and spirit in the world. That's okay to react against. You were called to do that. But I wouldn't focus all of your time on that. Focus on what's beautiful, truthful, positive at the same time. And then I will also say, I think my friend Jason from the 2-Bit podcast has deemed this, we're exiting the spirit of the devouring mother, which we certainly saw throughout the 60s. And I think ended at some point in 2020. I mean, that was the devouring mother spirit. And we're heading into the vengeful son. The most dangerous part of the vengeful son spirit is that it will feel good to people on the right. I don't want to see a trans person hanging from a lamppost.
Do you think Elon Musk represents that ethos at all?
Yes. When he sat in front of that big room full of people and someone asked him about, well, how can you don't want to offend the head of Disney or whatever. And Elon gave two birds. That's vengeful son. That game stonk thing that happened a couple of years ago where they're like, we're going to short all these rich people on Wall Street with these gamer stocks or whatever. And they asked the guy that was the head of it. It's like, well, you're going to go broke too doing this. And he goes, I don't care. I just want them to pay because they hurt my father. The Wall Street people. That's the vengeful son. I would just say be careful of going too far and that feeling good, because it's to some extent you're using, that's the same energy that's enveloping the bad people on the left, and you're just inverting it into your own will. And I would warn to be careful of that.
I think there's a book called The Politics of Despair. I think it's by Fritz Stern. I think that's his name. But he really draws this out that, and I think Trump kind of represents some of the early stages of this, where look, we're just ticked off. Like, yes. You know, Trump is just a proxy. Like, if you say Trump's a bad guy, well, then that's exactly my reason for voting for him, because I hate you. You know, you've destroyed my life. You destroyed my heritage. You destroyed every aspect of what was good in my own childhood memory. Of course, I want you dead. I don't care about the consequences. Right. That's not something that builds. That's something that destroys. And maybe we do have to undermine the regime, but we also have to think about building.
Yeah, we need I do think Trump was very necessary. We needed him to come in like the bull in China shop and kind of shatter and wreck things. But we need like a Pat Buchanan to come in here and order things nicely now, something like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think with Pat Buchanan, that's a great way to end the show, because I do think he's the man that we didn't deserve sort of in the 90s. But he represents, I mean, I'll let you finish with this too, but because you asked me if, like a bunch of trivia questions about my favorite people, but let me get that right back at you. Like, what do you think of people like Ron Paul and Pat Buchanan and people like that still?
Wonderful. I have nothing but good things. I've met Ron Paul many times in person. I've been to his house. There's no one I've ever met that's more kind, genuine, and just loving than as far in that realm of society than he is. He's the real deal. He's an amazing human being.
It makes you sort of glad that he didn't become president, because they would have destroyed him. And while Trump can take it, you just don't want to see that happen to the Paul family.
I remember a couple of years ago, I don't even like bringing this up, but he had a medical incident, if you will, I wouldn't watch it. I didn't want to see it. Oh, just look at it. I don't know. That's the last thing I want to see is something bad happen to him.
Yeah.
And Pat Buchanan, I've never met, but I certainly love his writings. And it's neat to go. You could still, obviously, you guys know, go on YouTube and online and find some old clips of him on Crossfire and some of these shows like that. And he's just, wow, what were we thinking? You know, like, why was he not president? What the heck? But the right was enveloped in this neoconservative, neoliberal, if you will, interventionist foreign policy kind of mindset that just warped and ruined that movement.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess in summary here, you know, the right needs our religious past to be sustainable. And I think religion can't ignore politics forever. There's something that about, you know, the human, about humanity that requires it to, you know, look to the heavens in order to guide its way on earth. And I think that's just, it's something that's been denied over the 20th century. And it's something that can be denied no longer. So, Buck, I appreciate your time on this. And I guess the last question is, where can people find you?
Counterflow Podcast is the show. It's anywhere that you listen to a podcast. If you type in Counterflow, you can find it. Go on YouTube, Odyssey, Rumble, all of that. I'm there. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Buck Rebel, BuckRebel. I came up with Buck Rebel as my email back when I was still into the secessionist Southern stuff. So it still sticks.
Yeah, well, cool. Thanks for joining me. It was a great conversation.
Thanks, CJ.